Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Living out our faith every day. That's what we're all about here at Faith Radio and Connecting Faith. Glad to have you tuned in. I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross at the controls, and Chris Rogers at the phones. And we're going to talk today about thriving in Babylon. Larry Osborne has written a great book with that title. And in the book, he says, winning or losing is not the right scorecard. Obedience is. When we do the right thing, we're being faithful, even if we get the wrong results. Now, maybe you've experienced some of the what you'd say wrong results on life's journey, but I want to encourage you to stay tuned today. He also said in the book, fear and pessimism make no sense when victory is guaranteed. We're going to take a long view approach today. I'm looking forward to that.
A little recentering conversation.
It'll be good.
Yes.
It brings to mind, Peter's question, 2 Peter, how shall we then live? Well, today we're going to learn some principles for thriving in Babylon. I think the subtitle really says it well, why hope, humility, and wisdom matter in a godless culture.
Mm-hmm.
So coming up, we'll get to that. A couple notes before we dive in. I just learned of Cliff Barrow's passing yesterday at age 93.
Yeah, I was privileged to sing under him, as thousands of others were, in the Billy Graham Crusade Choir once. So.
Yeah, he was amazing. He served as music and program director for the BGEA, Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, for I think it was some 60 years or
wow.
So. Amazing. He and George Beverly Say and Billy Graham, that trio, led that ministry for a number of years. Quite a legacy.
Mm-hmm. Impacted thousands around the world for Christ.
Amazing. Yesterday was World Adoption Day, and during National Adoption Month, and Focus on the Family has a little booklet called RAP to help people understand how to best come alongside adoptive families. RAP stands for Wrestle in Prayer, Respite Care, Acts of Service, and Promises of God. And you can find out more at focusonthefamily.com. So, if you're maybe have an adopted child or you have experienced that, just want to say salute to you and thanks for that important step. And one other note, our University of Northwestern Eagles, Faith Radio is based on the University of Northwestern campus in St. Paul, and the Eagles volleyball team made it to the Elite Eight.
Very good.
Playing
in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
I know you're a volleyball kind of aficionado.
Oh, yeah. So. My daughter's big into it, too.
Anyway, hats off to the ladies there. And speaking of the NCAA and tournaments, John Stone Street has a thought about the influence of the LGBT community.
How pliant the NCAA is in the hands of LGBT activists. For the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. When North Carolina dared require people to use bathrooms that match their sex, the NCAA yanked 7 conference championships from the state. Next up, the Big 12. That athletic conference was set to expand, that is, bring in another university to increase member schools' revenue and enhance the conference's status. High on the list was Brigham Young University. Good football program, excellent academics, Salt Lake City media market, sounds appealing. But wait, BYU is Mormon, and BYU's code of conduct actually requires students to live a chaste and virtuous life. That was just too much for LGBT groups who lobbied the Big 12 to drop BYU from consideration. The Iowa State student government petitioned the Big 12 to forget BYU, whose policies are, quote, inconsistent with Big 12 values. That means, I suppose, that Big 12 and LGBT values don't include chastity and virtue. Small surprise, BYU will not be in the Big 12. I'm John Stone Street.
Talking thriving in Babylon today, an important topic and some great insight just ahead. Glad to have you listening in. Larry Osborne is my guest. Dr. Larry Osborne has served as a senior pastor and teaching pastor at North Coast Church. It's a significant, influential church in our nation since 1980, when it started with just a fledgling group, a little over 100, and now they're a multi-site church with thousands meeting each week. He's written a number of books, including Accidental Pharisees, Sticky Church, 10 Dumb Things That Smart Christians Believe. And the one we're going to reference today is called Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. And Larry does a lot of speaking and teaching and encouraging, and we're always thankful for the opportunity to connect with gifted leaders, church leaders that give us good insight into the world in which we live. You know the story of Daniel, probably, right? But Daniel experienced a fast-changing, godless society, and he faced fears about the future, concern for his safety, and the discouragement of a world that seemed to be falling apart at warp speed. If that sounds familiar, then you're going to be encouraged today as we talk Thriving in Babylon. And we live in a culture that is moving away from spiritual roots and heritage. So how do we make that work? We're going to find out here in the moments ahead.
Yeah, we're having a little trouble connecting with him at the moment, so we'll get him on the line here in just a second.
Larry Osborne has been our guest in the past. In fact, we've talked with Larry about the book Thriving in Babylon, and we do have some copies of the book to give away. So I want to encourage you to check in with us at 877-93-FAITH and just sign up for this. You'll find it very insightful and helpful and encouraging. Larry, welcome back to Connecting Faith. Good to talk with you.
Yeah, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
You know, maybe to start, paint a little picture of Babylon at the time of Daniel. And we think we know the story from Sunday school days, but maybe we haven't read the account like we should.
Yeah, we often think of Daniel as a kid's adventure story or maybe kind of a prophecy primer. But in reality, it's a primer for adults, how to live in a godless and thrive in a godless environment. Because Babylon was actually perhaps the worst and most godless place of all history. When the angels shout out, according to the book of Revelation, when Jesus is going to return, they cry out, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon." You know, not Nazi Germany, not Sodom, Gomorrah. It's kind of the image and the word picture of the worst to this day in the heavenly realm. So it was a bad place.
Hmm. Well, you know, there's we think there's a lot of similarities, and there are some today, but I guess we tend to look pessimistically at most any generation. Things are always seem like they're always worse. Talk about maybe our common reaction when we're in a culture that's increasingly secular here.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I mean, all of us can miss the sense of history or whatever, because wherever we are right now seems so real. I like to say we're like fish in water. You ask a fish, how's the water? And it says, what water? Because it's all it knows. And we often, like all people throughout history, have a hard time getting perspective. And definitely, we're in a place and a time where godly qualities and godly values are being pushed more and more aside. But my goodness, we are in a great space compared to other Christians at other times in history. But even so, we still want to follow the plan of, I call it the Daniel plan, but it's not a diet, it's a lifestyle. That's, no matter how godless it gets, that's the path of obedience that brings honor to the Lord.
You know, we're going to dive into that a bit more about, you know, what that plan looks like, but I guess maybe counter that with what we tend to focus on and, you know, words like disillusionment, despair, fear, pessimism, and I suppose it may depend on, I suppose, how people voted in this past election, you know, whether they're feeling any of those or not at all.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because we're so right now. You know, God writes his history in centuries. And in the book of Hebrews, he tells us that those who won in their battles and those who lost and had to live destitute and hide in caves and were persecuted, he said neither of them received their reward, what was promised in this life. And we so often think of the victories in this life as if that's the victory. But our great reward comes when Jesus returns. Everything that we get right now is just the hors d'oeuvres. So if the hors d'oeuvres are great, it's like, man, I don't even want to go to heaven. This is the greatest ever. And when the hors d'oeuvres aren't what we want to walk out not realizing, yeah, maybe the hors d'oeuvres aren't so great, but the banquet will be unbelievable.
Well, one of the main themes, I guess, running through Daniel is that God is sovereign. And so let's talk a bit about that. How would a clear understanding of the sovereignty of God impact, how should it impact how we live today?
Well, I think it changes everything. When I know two things, one, he's sovereign and he's promised that we win, who cares what the score is in the third quarter? I mean, I'd rather be ahead, but bottom line, I know how it's going to end. And I always like to point out in the book of Daniel something that was never pointed out to me in the Sunday school classes I grew up in, because I was privileged to grow up in a Christian home. And that is, at the very beginning, he says, in the third year of Jehoiakim, that the Lord delivered Jerusalem over to godless, damnable Nebuchadnezzar. And he even delivered things from the temple over to Nebuchadnezzar so he could take him back and put him in the satanic temple of his demon god Baal. And that's like the foundation as Daniel tells his story. Daniel's not a diary. He's looking back at his life and writing his story. He says, before you understand anything about what I did, how I thought, how I responded to anybody, you need to understand, even as a young man kidnapped and taken far away to Babylon, godless Babylon, I understood that God's in control of who's in control. Whether I like it or don't, God's not making a mistake. And that changes everything about our thought processes all the way through to our actions.
Now, if we review the story, we think, well, there was, you know, he didn't eat the king, Daniel didn't eat the king's food. His friends didn't get burned in the furnace. He came out of the lion's den, so he was a winner. But there was more to it than that, wasn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, I like to point out, as a kid, I thought the main lesson of Daniel, if I'm courageous and stand up for what is right, the lions can't eat me and the fire can't burn me. But if that's so, then the Lord has a lot of explaining to do, because throughout all history, everybody else thrown to hungry lions was eaten, and everybody else burned at the martyr stake died. So the lesson is a lesson of courage and obedience and bringing glory to the Lord, whatever happens, not a message of, well, everything will work out right now.
So let's talk about, you know, Daniel, you know, was a man of courage. He stood up for his beliefs, but he still, you know, respected authority. How does that work together today? What should that look like for us to be able to thrive in Babylon?
Yeah, and I find that there's a very fascinating, at least to me, fascinating difference between the way that those of us who follow Jesus in America view other American Christians versus overseas, a missionary. Because when a missionary comes alongside a godless person, you know, he takes a picture of him and the witch doctor. We put it on a refrigerator as something to remember to pray for them, and we're so excited that he's making inroads. But if an American Christian becomes close to those who represent the enemy's game plan, you know, they're cast off as a compromiser or something different. And I'm thinking, well, that's a bit unique. Because what stands out about Daniel is how humble and respectful he was, even to godless Nebuchadnezzar. In fact, he served in Nebuchadnezzar's cabinet so well, he kept getting promoted until he got to the highest points where he could turn the light on the God Most High instead of all the things that the magicians and everybody else were depending on. So you don't get promoted if you don't serve well and if you're not respectful. That doesn't happen.
I want to talk more about that. What does it mean to serve well? To be respectful, to grow in our influence in the midst of a culture that doesn't value and affirm a Christian belief. We're talking thriving in Babylon today, why hope, humility, and wisdom matter in a godless culture. It's a timely book for today, written by Dr. Larry Osborne. Larry is a senior pastor, has served as senior pastor and teaching pastor at North Coast Church in Oceanside, California, and he's a popular speaker and a teacher, a father and a grandfather, and we're glad to have him with us today. We do have some copies of Thriving in Babylon to give away, and you're welcome to sign up for that. We'll do a little drawing at the end of the hour. It's 877-933-2484. If you'd like to get a copy of this great little book, 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question or a comment, you're welcome to join the conversation as well. Maybe you've been dealing with some challenges in your sphere of influence, your world. Say, how do I actually thrive, live out my faith in an effective way? I'm glad to have you give us a call. And we'll talk about it on today's Connecting Faith. 877-93-FAITH. More with Larry Osborne in just a moment.
Build your kingdom.
Atmosphere in our nation has been shifting rather dramatically over the past few years, and And we maybe find more similarities than ever before with looking at the Old Testament story of Daniel in Babylon. And Larry Osborne has helped us see it through some new eyes. He's written a book called Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. Larry is a teaching pastor, a North Coast senior pastor and teaching pastor at North Coast Church in Oceanside, California, and author of a number of books, including Accidental Pharisees and Spirituality for the Rest of Us, The Unity Factor. And Larry, you're talking a little bit about Daniel growing in his influence. There had to be some probably compromises along the way, though, for him to be able to advance. That's always kind of a challenge for us, I guess. Do we stick to our convictions, or maybe what do we determine really are biblical absolutes?
Yeah, and you know what? There always is a little bit of fuzziness in that. There's no fuzziness where God has spoken absolutely, but I think one of the most common mistakes we make is we confuse sometimes our applications of a biblical principle with God's black and white rules, and also our preferences with what, you know, we make a confusion between what God forbids and what we don't like, and we put them in the same thing. For instance, Daniel had his name changed from God is my judge to Baal, who was a demon Satan god, Baal's prince. And he didn't seem to mind. Neither did his three buddies who had their name changed. Call me whatever you want as long as it's not late to dinner. Because as much as he wouldn't like it, there's no command against it. But there was a command against worshiping idols. So they said, no, whatever happens. There was a kosher diet that was clearly commanded. So they said, nope, we're not going to break it. But in other areas, even studying astrology and the occult, which is what the literature of the Chaldeans was, he didn't sit in the back row and sulk. He sat in the front row, took copious notes, and with the help of God, graduated number one in his class, which gave him the credibility to say this is junk. He was forbidden to practice it, but there was nothing that said he couldn't study it. And you find that unique distinction between what God explicitly forbids and what he, as a faithful Jew, didn't like. He constantly seemed to be able to thread that needle really well, which is why he kept getting the right to be heard.
There is, thinking as I was rereading the book again, that it does speak up to the importance of us as parents, I guess, trying to equip our kids as best we can at a young age, because, you know, we never know what the future would bring for them. But Daniel and his friends were taken at, you know, they were what, just young men when they were captured.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were young teenagers, part of the royal court.
So knowing what we believe and holding on to that is so important. You know, one of the things you talk about kind of early on is that we could have joy and should have joy in the midst of these situations where they're not, you know, they're not friendly to Christianity, if you will. But as some people would say, well, if you have joy, you just don't know what's going on. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, well, there's a sense of deeper joy. And I think when things are going south, we call you a masochist if you think that's wonderful. If you're sitting around watching a Job-like experience in your own life, tragedies, and you're just, you know, whistling, oh, this is great, something's not right between the ears. But there is a deeper joy that allowed the Apostle Paul, when he was in prison and being beaten, to write letters of joy. And what he didn't have was despair. And he had every reason to have despair because he didn't know the outcome of what was going to happen. At least as we would look at it, we would say, man, God is on the move, but a key leader has been in prison. Now he's being beaten. He might not get out. He might be killed. But he understood God's in control of who's in control. And I'm going to pray that I get out. I'm going to hope that I get out. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to find my identity and my hope in the things of this world. I'm going to find them in the confidence I have in the future. And that's what we so quickly forget in our day and age.
Which brings up, I guess, one of the important subpoints of the book, why hope, humility, and wisdom matter in a godless culture. Talk a little bit about hope. And you say we need some training oftentimes to really understand hope and live it out.
Yeah, in the English language, the word hope means I wish something happens. I hope you have a great vacation. I hope my team wins. But The biblical concept of hope is absolute confidence. When we call Jesus our blessed hope, we don't mean, boy, I kind of hope, I'm hopeful that he comes back. No, we mean, I am so sure he's coming back. It changes everything about how I live. And I think what has happened sometimes to us is we've lost hope. That, again, we keep checking the scoreboard when we've already been told how the game ends. I'm one of those guys who doesn't watch many games live. I tape them, and then when my team wins, I go back and watch them. So my team almost is undefeated every year. But anybody who's a sports fan knows that your greatest and fondest memories are not games where you won by a gazillion points, but games where you were hopelessly behind and somehow pulled it out. We love miracles, but we forget it takes a mess to have a miracle. And at the end of the day, we have been absolutely assured that we win. I'm on the welcoming committee, not the programming committee, when it comes to Revelation. I don't understand all the details. I can't tell you right now who the Antichrist is or whatever. But I have peeked. I have looked, and it says we win. And once I know that, like I said, well, the further I'm behind in third quarter, then the greater the fourth quarter comeback is going to be.
So does that, if we hang on to that hope, we know that Jesus is coming back, there will be a day when all will be made right, does that mean we just sort of pull back and isolate and say, well, it doesn't really matter what happens in our culture, the world will, can just continue to unravel?
No, I think we're always called to be salt and we're always called to be light. And we happen to live in a culture where we have a very strong voice. It still has to be a godly voice. We can't fight fire with fire and use the weapons of the world where they're disrespectful or whatever, and so therefore we don't want to be respectful. But at the end of the day, we're allowed to be part of the process. And I look at any Christian who says I'm not going to be part of the process is missing it big time. But our hope isn't in the process. And if somehow we were ever marginalized and not allowed in the process, well, welcome to most Christians and most of history. We still can honor Jesus quite well in that environment. In fact, I like to point out, if you were to go back in time, we would have thought the worst had happened in China and the Iron Curtain because Christianity was essentially forbidden and kicked out. And we would have said, well, at least we have freedom of religion and all this in Western Europe. But in God's overarching time frame, we look at now and we go, wow. He was really at work behind the scenes in the places that we thought there was no freedom, far more than in the places that we felt like, wow, at least we, weren't shut out of this place.
Talking Thriving in Babylon today with Dr. Larry Osborne, who's a teaching pastor at North Coast Church in Southern California. He's author of a number of books, including Accidental Pharisees. The book we're referencing today is called Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. We're going to talk about the wisdom approach. We'll get to talking a bit about spiritual warfare model, some of those things, and get some encouragement for us day by day as we continue on with Dr. Osborne. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us and sign up for a copy of the book as well. It's 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Or you can submit your question online. Go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. And there's an email link there. You can submit your question. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment as we talk Thriving in Babylon. Possible to thrive in a culture that is fast changing and godless? Maybe you're fearful, disheartened, disillusioned, perhaps. Maybe this past election was just one of those difficult seasons in your life. Say, what is the answer? Well, today we're finding out from Dr. Larry Osborne from North Coast Church. He's a senior pastor and teaching pastor there, an author and a speaker. In fact, there's a lot of leadership consulting and training to churches and church leaders and pastors. And we're talking about his book, Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. Larry, I know that we tend to, I guess, either withdraw or resist. You suggest there's maybe a couple other ways to approach how we have the right kind of impact in the world in which we live.
Yeah, and there is a sense of resisting, and that's whenever I'm called personally to do something sinful. Of course, I stand firm, and my answer is no, no matter what the consequences are. But there's always been a tendency to try to run away rather than to infiltrate. And at the end of the day, salt has to get outside of the salt shaker, and light has to be taken out from under what covers it. And the Great Commission is that we go into all the world, which was a godless world, and we meet non-Jesus followers, help them become disciples, and keep at it until they're trained to obey everything Jesus taught us. So everything in the biblical mandate that we've been given is not to isolate and hunker down, but to move forward, but again, using the weapons of the Spirit, not the weapons of the flesh, not the anger, the resentment, the whatever, the sense of humility and the sense of righteousness that Jesus has called us for. But I like to say no contact, no impact, and it's always been that way.
Even, you know, understanding that there is a spiritual element to it. You do talk about that, you know, the spiritual warfare model, we need to be wise about that as well, though, right?
Yeah, I think a strange thing has happened. If you listen closely over the years, spiritual warfare has become more and more, in our circles, something that we would call cultural warfare. But spiritual warfare, when you look carefully at the passages, man, they were written under godless Rome where Christianity was illegal. They're much more about our spiritual battle as Christians to live a righteous life than they are to take on our culture. A much better word picture, if we'd wake up with it, would change everything, would be persuasion. We're not called to warfare against our world. We're called to persuasion when we run into those that don't know Jesus. And, you know, when I have a warfare mindset, I want to wipe you out. When I have a persuasion mindset, I'm asking, how can I win you over? Very, very different things.
So when you preach and teach, do you talk moral issues a lot, or how does that work? And, I mean, do you get criticized for maybe not taking strong enough stands on some issues?
Yeah, we definitely get criticized here because we tend to be more apolitical. And so people want to, as I see it, hijack us and turn us into a political force, especially because we're one of the largest churches in the country, much less this region. But at the end of the day, I keep going back to 1 Corinthians 5, where you know, we're told to take care of ourselves inside. So we preach on sin very, very clearly. We're very clear about what is and what isn't, and that a Christian must live a certain lifestyle. But most people want me to try to clean up the life of non-Christians when, frankly, that's not their biggest problem. Their biggest problem is they need to come to Jesus, and then he'll clean it up from the inside out.
So talk more about the wisdom approach today, because we're talking about thriving in Babylon, why hope, humility, and wisdom matter in a godless culture. I mean, common sense is a little short supply. Maybe wisdom is as well.
Absolutely. Well, you know, wisdom picks its battles carefully. That's the way I describe it, especially in this book, looking at Daniel, where, as we said earlier, he knew the difference between what he didn't like and what God forbade. A practical illustration I give to folks is Jesus is my Savior. He rescued me from an eternity in hell that I deserved. He laid down his life for me. I can't stand it when someone uses my Lord and Savior's name as a swear word. At all. But you know what? It's not forbidden for those who aren't Jesus followers. I mean, they're living in disobedience everywhere. So imagine I've got somebody in the cubicle. The lack of wisdom will try to clean up their life and go after them and almost become an enemy, in which I lose the ability to persuade them. Wisdom would say, you know, their biggest issue is they need to come to Jesus. And so I move towards them, even though there are many things I don't particularly like. Jesus certainly didn't like the lifestyle of the woman at the well. Jesus didn't like the lifestyle of the sinners he hung around, and he didn't join, and he called them to a new change, but he won them over. He didn't try to just wall them off.
Is there a step or two in terms of persuasion that you kind of keep coming back to? And is it about the humility? I know that's one of the things you talk about, that we don't think maybe more highly of ourselves than we ought to.
Yeah. Humility in American English has come to mean, you know, you're the fastest kid in the class, but you say, oh, I'm not very good. Well, that's not humility. That's just blowing smoke. Humility, biblically, is treating others as if they were more important than yourself. It's Jesus washing feet, even though he's Lord and Master, and saying, now, I want you to go out and do this. Jesus isn't saying, you are better than me, that's why I'm washing your feet. He's saying, I'm going to treat you as if you're that. Philippians, do nothing out of selfishness or empty conceit. Consider the needs of others as more important than your own. And that's what you find in Daniel all along. And virtually every response he has, even when he's saying, I won't eat the non-kosher diet, he is so polite and respectful. Even when he gets to tell Nebuchadnezzar that, okay, your time has come and God is bringing a judgment on you, he doesn't say, hey, dude, I've been praying this forever. I'm glad to bring you the news. He says, O king, I wish it was anybody but you. Incredible respect and humility. And that's what opened the door for him to keep getting promoted and to, again, have the opportunity to speak truth into a very dark place. We've lost that art, I believe.
And, you know, somehow I guess we've looked at, say, well, the lack of promotion, you know, we've looked at it as, well, it's been attacked because of our faith, and it may have nothing to do with that. It might be our competence, right?
Yeah, our competence, or just we're, frankly, I call them jerks for Jesus. I've had some people who just wear their faith on a very judgmental, harsh sleeve, and then they come to me and they say, man, my faith is just destroying my career. And I go, it's not your faith that's destroying your career. It's your jerkiness. That none of us ever like someone who looks down on us or treats us with disrespect. And that's true if you do that towards me, and that's true of anybody I do that towards.
And we all, as children, dearly loved children, I think it says in Hebrews, that God is going to discipline us, so there's going to be probably times of testing and trial that's going to come our way anyway, and we probably shouldn't be surprised at that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Peter wrote to a persecuted church, far worse than our situation, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal as if something strange has happened. And when I am surprised as if something strange has happened, the tragedy is then I decide, you know, God's way hasn't really worked, so I'm going to fight fire with fire, and I'm going to take the world's weapons. And at the end of the day, now things just get worse. They never get better.
Talking today with Larry Osborne about his book, Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. It came out, I think, what, maybe a year ago, or not quite, but have things changed as you look back across the cultural landscape? And, you know, would you have said things, written things differently since when you first released it?
No, not really. I think the biggest surprise to me was an election in which so many people, even people of faith, were kind of distraught over all the choices. And so it has given the book an interesting boost. So that was unforeseen. Because the culture, I think, is going to continue to move in the directions it's moving. Horse is out of the barn. But I didn't expect such a confusing time as the last few months have been. And it clearly has spoken to a lot of people in light of that.
Thank you. You used the words spiritual myopia and spiritual amnesia. Maybe just say a bit about clarifying those two.
Well, spiritual myopia reminds me of Psalm 73, where a guy named Asaph is looking around and he says, man, living for God hasn't worked for me. The godless are all successful. And then the Lord takes him and says, let me take you in the tabernacle and let me show you their end, their destiny. And he suddenly goes, oops, oh, okay, everything's fine. So myopia is when I judge God's goodness by today instead of by yesterday and all of his promises for tomorrow. And spiritual amnesia is what the children of Israel and so many of us constantly experience. You know, a couple of days after they're marvelously released from Egypt, they're screaming at Moses and God because they're about to be overtaken because they're up against a couple of mountains in the Red Sea and the Egyptian army's coming towards them. And God's like, no, I got a plan. I'm wiping out the Egyptians, not you. But amnesia forgets his blessings of yesterday and worries about the trials of today.
Do you find yourself preaching more on God's sovereignty as you continue to advance in your teaching and preaching career?
Well, I think so in a sense, but I mean, we work through book studies here rather than, you know, just a topic, but it is just such a strong undercurrent. And when things are going well, I don't think we think much about God's sovereignty. But it's when things aren't going the way we want, either personally in our life or culturally, that we need to go back to that cornerstone of faith, that he's in control of who's in control. He's not up there surprised.
And I think that the key word is thriving, isn't it? It's not just about surviving, but thriving. It can be done.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, Daniel had three regimes and three revivals that he led, over 70 years of lifetime. So it wasn't just a kind of one-hit wonder. The real Daniel plan of how to respond to godlessness works time after time, regime after regime.
Larry Osborne has served as senior pastor and teaching pastor at North Coast Church. It's one of the 10 most influential churches in the country, and he's author of a number of books, including Accidental Pharisees, and the one we're referencing is called Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. We've got some copies to give away, and I recommend it to you. Larry, good to visit with you again. Thanks for stopping by today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and an honor. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. Larry Osborne, guest today as we talk thriving in Babylon.
We were made to be courageous, and we're taking back the fight. We were made to be courageous, and it starts with us tonight. The only way we'll ever stand is on our knees with lifted hands. Make us courageous. Lord, make us courageous.
Once again, to connect with Leith Anderson, president of the National Association of Evangelicals and a longtime pastor of Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. And he has authored some 15 books, and we are honored to have him with us on a regular basis just to talk about culture and life and faith. Leith, so last time we talked, it was just before Election Day. The election is over now. Obviously, country still has a lot of divisions, a lot of issues that divide us, so what does the Bible say about winning and losing?
Well, the Bible has a lot of stories about winners and losers. It's interesting. Jesus didn't really ever call us to be winners. He called us to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. So that ought to be our primary approach. We should have a deep belief that God uses all kinds of circumstances for his good. And the great story is Joseph in the Old Testament. I mean, he just lost. He lost at home. He lost with his brothers. He lost in his job. He lost in prison. I mean, the guy was just a loser. And then he comes to the realization that what others intended for evil, God intended for good. And God saved the lives of millions of people. And it was just absolutely marvelous what God accomplished. And so we need to keep that perspective. You know, I've asked hundreds, probably thousands of people, when is the time you were closest to God in your life? And people tell about a loss, about a crisis, about losing jobs and family members. And there may be somebody out there. No one has ever said to me, the closest I ever was to Jesus was the day I won $10 million in the lottery. It's not the day they got their promotion. It's not the day they won some prize. It's the difficult time. So what we should do is say that we're going to trust God, win or lose, and be totally devoted to him.
It's sometimes hard to take that long perspective, though, isn't it? To even as Joseph, I mean, realized it, but there was a lot of time, you know, in the dungeon, if you will, too, and just not being able to see the bright side of that, I guess.
But that's who we are as Christians, that we are faithful to God, and we believe in God and his sovereignty, even in circumstances that we would never choose. And that's what Joseph did so well. I mean, he was faithful to God when it seemed to him, I'm sure, that God maybe had abandoned him, but it wasn't true. And he was faithful to God because he knew God was there even in the days he may have seemed like he was abandoned.
Leith, you know, I've noticed on news reports and things that a lot of people have lost actual close friendships, years of friendships over this election. There's been a lot of divisiveness and things like that. Now's the time to come back together, though, and maybe some people think that my relationship's irreparable with my old friend. What's your recommendation for them on the first step toward reconciliation?
Take this as an opportunity to live Christianly, to be kind and gracious and loving to people, and don't wait for them to come to you. You go to them and tell them, you know, as a Christian, it's really important to me that I have a good and a right relationship with you, regardless of political differences that we may have. I seize this as an opportunity to be Jesus Christ in this circumstance.
I saw a bumper sticker some 8 years ago that said, pray for the president, and the Bible reference was Psalm 109, verse 8. And when I got home and looked it up, it kind of made me chuckle because, this, you know, pray, may his days in office be few. Kind of made me laugh, I guess. But it did make me wonder, but, you know, how should we – is it legitimate to pray for a leader that maybe we don't agree with for an early departure or, you know, talk about praying for our leaders and those in authority. We're commanded to do that.
I'm waiting for you to ask me if I've ever prayed for somebody in authority to die.
I want to know if you've had that bumper sticker on your car. No,
it does make me wonder where the bumper sticker industry actually is centered. I mean, who are the people that come up with these things? Okay, so let's be biblical and theological. That psalm is what is called an imprecatory psalm. Mm. And those are psalms, and there are a number of them, that are actually praying down God's wrath and judgment against enemies. So, yeah, there's a biblical precedent for that. If you read the entire psalm, you also see David confessing his own sins with great humility and referring to God as being sovereign. So if that's into it, I guess that's okay. But I think it ought to be in prayers and probably not on bumper stickers. If we feel that God needs to intervene and replace one leader with another, then talk to God about it. Let God make the final decision. But kind of keep your mouth open to God and closed to others.
You're mentioning Joseph, and I was thinking about Jeremiah 29, how we love that verse about, you know, God has plans for us, you know, for prosper and not to harm us. But there's a section before that. Does that speak to our day today?
I have read that part of Jeremiah more this past year than any other time in my life. And it is a fascinating story of circumstance where the people of Israel were captured, were taken from Jerusalem, which was essentially destroyed, and they're enslaved as a captive people in Babylon. And they want to go back home, and they want to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And their prophets are saying, that's exactly what's going to happen. Just pray and you'll go back to Jerusalem and everything will be the way it was before. And that's when Jeremiah comes in as the spokesperson for God and says, it ain't going to happen. And here's what you're supposed to do. Plant gardens, build houses, get married, have children, make Babylon prosper. Bless the place that has captured you. And God has a plan. And the plan is to get you back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple, and it's going to happen in 70 years. And that's longer than the lifespan of these people. So what they're supposed to do is be faithful to God in circumstances that they did not want and did not choose, and honor God in a place that they did not want to be.
You know, with the holidays here upon us now, Thanksgiving coming up very soon, and Christmas, of course, around the corner, the family is going to gather, and there's probably that one relative that always likes to talk faith and politics, the things that you're not supposed to talk about, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Neil, you were telling me about this.
I had a deceased brother-in-law, but those family dinners were pretty uncomfortable because he was very dogmatic about his opinions, and it was, you kind of cringed as you ate your mashed potatoes and wish you could kind of slink away right away after lunch.
So, Leith, what do you recommend for people that have to deal with a relative like this?
You're reminding me of a time when a news reporter left her microphone on and went into the ladies' room and talked to a stranger about her brother-in-law and just beat up on him.
Oh, man.
And it was broadcast over a speech by the President of the United States. And when it was reported in the news outlets, they said exactly this. Isn't that family going to have an interesting Thanksgiving dinner?
Yes.
So I would say think about it in advance. Think in advance about what you're going to say and how you're going to handle it. And if somebody is really a problem, then talk to them, have a plan on how you're going to deal with them, and think through how does a Christian handle this situation? What does a Christian say? Maybe have some verses that you've memorized in advance. And it's not to beat up on the other person. It's not to beat them down and to win. It's to say, how does Jesus come into this type of conversation? And honestly, it can be more difficult in a family circumstance on a holiday than at any other time in any other place.
In your book, Faith in the Voting Booth, you do talk about civility. And I guess, you know, we've sort of touched on that, that that's important all the time. It certainly is. Christians, we have to be winsome and loving. But is civility, how do we understand it? Does that mean, particularly in post-election time, that you know we acquiesce to the people that are in power?
It does not mean that. In fact, I think if we are going to be civil, we can state our principles and we can argue for biblical truth, but we can do it in a way that is polite. Richard Mao, in a famous book on civility, has defined civility as public politeness. So my office is in Washington, and I interact with loads of people who have very different views and convictions than mine. And I always try to treat them with respect, hear what they have to say, and I find that they are then open and willing to hear what I have to say. They're curious about it. And I'm an evangelical Christian. Sometimes they have misperceptions about evangelical Christians. And my favorite is at the end of the conversation when they say, I'm really impressed with you as an evangelical in that you treat me with respect, you hear what I have to say, and I want to hear what you have to say. So it's a good thing. It's not only biblical. The Bible clearly teaches us to set aside anger and bitterness and to treat people with kindness and that we speak Christianly. But it's also effective. It's the most effective way of accomplishing what we want to do.
A great conversation once again with Leith Anderson, president of the National Association of Evangelicals, longtime pastor at the Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, and author, speaker. I always love having you here, Leith. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Chris Wynn went to a lot of parties and had a lot of fun, but no surprise, after a while, he found himself looking for deeper meaning in life and purpose for himself. Hi, I'm Steve Douglas for Making Your Life Count, and Chris explains.
I was deep into the early snowboard culture, you know, live fast and die before 30. That was the goal of all me and my friends. At a party, someone mentioned, if you're into philosophy, and I was at the time because I was seeking, they said you should read Ecclesiastes. And I did. I went and found a Bible. It was like my whole being came awake. And then I moved quickly to the Gospels and where I found that Jesus was the only way to God.
What an amazing story. It doesn't really matter when or where. God can grab your attention and draw you to faith in Him.
I always love hearing those stories of life change. And I mean, there's somebody that you're praying for that God will do just that. We believe that He will. I want to grow in our faith day by day, make connections between faith and life. We've got a great opportunity for you. The Charles Stanley Life Principles Bible is the resource we're giving away this month. In fact, I'm giving a copy away each week. It's designed to lead believers into life-changing relationship with Christ. It's leather-bound, large print. It's autographed, and we'd love to send you one. You sign up for it online at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com, the Charles Stanley Life Principles Bible, and you'll find yourself getting some good answers to maybe some life questions. And speaking of answers, Ted, tomorrow it's our opportunity to get questions answered on the Bible, faith in the church, or maybe even reaction to something you heard on today's show.
Monthly Ask the Professor show, Professors Mark Muska, Brad Sickler from the University of Northwestern St. Paul, the religion department there. They come in studio and field those questions. You can actually submit yours right now at myfaithradio.com. Click on the Connecting Faith show page. Scroll down on the left-hand side, and you'll see it right there.
So just use that tab, the Ask the Professor tab, and submit your question, and we'll get queued up and get right after it to tomorrow on Connecting Faith. Hope that you'll join us for this great hour. It's always a good time, and looking forward to getting conversation with you about some questions, things you've been wondering about. If you missed part of today's show, you can always find it. We post our interviews on our show page, the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. You'll also find a number of other great interviews and conversations there that you can share with a friend. So check it out online at myfaithradio.com.